This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight to the Grit Talk. What I'm about to do is to illuminate a little bit some of the research that I've been doing with some of my students. So let me give credit to those students first. George Chen has done the bulk of the work that you're going to see here. But people like Kitty Currier and Tom Pingle, you'll see their photos and you'll see the work as we go past it. So let me define not the great indoors, but the great outdoors. What is the great outdoors? It's here. It's all around us, probably best represented in California by the Yosemite Valley. What an extraordinary place. I heard an announcement yesterday on NPR that the average child now spends between 7 and 11 minutes outdoors every day. Pretty sorry situation. So in cartography, we map topography. We map the surface of the Earth and its features. Here's a three-dimensional rendering of the USGS map of the same Yosemite Valley. So in terms of mapping, at least from the United States point of view, the national map is really complete. The United States Geological Survey was founded in 1879 with the purpose of taking an inventory, just simply mapping out and surveying all of the property that became available from the Mexican-American Wars and the Louisiana Purchase. Before this, there had been three different separate surveys, primarily of the West, and putting these together to form a great survey was very much a vision. So in 1884, they started the National Mapping Program to map the great outdoors in the United States, and they finished in 1992, 108 years later. That's how long it took to map this country. They moved to an automatic digital map production format in 2008, which means that they can repeat that 108-year process every 5 years now. So you might argue that we've finished mapping the country. They've digitized not only the current maps, but 179,000 historical maps as well. So we've already mapped much of the great outdoors. We have great map exploration tools. I'm sure you've used them, Google Earth, Google Maps, Bing Maps, and so on. To this, we've added not just topographic imagery, but also images from space and from cameras, examples being the Landsat data, which is now public domain and available to anybody, and things like Google Street View, which are sort of continuously recorded images of our landscape. And recently, we've seen volunteered mapping efforts, and the best-known one is OpenStreetMap. So we've probably all seen pictures like this of Google Maps and Google Earth. Here we go to the Yosemite Valley. We can go into Google Street View and rotate the cameras, look at panoramic three-dimensional views, and look at the landscape from the same place. And OpenStreetMap is a user-contributed mapping service where people can go take their own GPS receivers or their cell phones, map their tracks, and then log them into the system and continuously update the map, not just of the United States, but of the world. But, as I said, we spend a lot of our times indoors. It's been estimated that we spend at least 80% of our day indoors in any given time. And one of the disadvantages is that once we get indoors, that mapping mode, the GPS signal on our cell phone or on our GPS receiver, essentially turns off. It's a very low-energy microwave signal, and it just doesn't penetrate roofs and walls. I should say, by the way, that we usually say GPS, but the correct term is GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite System, of which there are now four or five in full operation. So there's no equivalent indoors for pressing the button on your GPS receiver, or there's no equivalent for latitude and longitude, or no equivalent to something like the National Grid that we have printed on our topographic maps. And interior space mapping, I would argue, is where the USGS was in 1879 before it started to even begin the national mapping program for the country. So what is indoor space? How do we define it? Well, we've thought about this a little bit for the purposes of the project that we've been doing. We define it as any covering surface like a roof or a surface over the top of an enclosed space and at least one wall, but often it means four walls, a floor, and a ceiling. So it includes offices, theaters, stadiums, hotels, airports, stations, houses, caves, metro tunnels, all places where you might want access to the kinds of services that we take for granted, like Google Earth and Google Maps. A common element here is that within these spaces, they are we can't get the GPS signals, so we can't do automated positioning. And we have included in our interior spaces what we call movable spaces or enclosed movable spaces that include things like aircraft, cruise ships, or large cars or trucks that might move around but carry their own geometry around with them. So there have been some early efforts to establish positioning systems for indoors, mostly using Wi-Fi signals by tracking the Wi-Fi transmitters within an enclosed space and looking at their relative strengths. You can sort of triangulate your position, but these so far are no better than about 100 meters, which often puts you outside a building that you might be inside. And we've also seen some infrared efforts for mapping interior space. Probably the best known one is Microsoft Kinect, which opened up a lot of video game interaction by being able to track human movement within a space. But we can also turn it around and use it to map that space. So why should we bother about mapping interior spaces? Well, first thing is that we can deliver mobile location-based services. You know, a good example that we use on campus here is the interactive campus map, which was written primarily by undergraduate students here in geography, which has an enormous amount of detail for the campus. And you can navigate around on it using your cell phone and its GPS capabilities. But the minute you walk into a building, its ability to locate you just disappears. So we might want to use services inside. We often use services in classrooms. The iClicker signals, for example, are broadcast within classrooms, but no way to locate either the student or the space. We'd like to give directions and provide maps. So giving directions to my office, let's say, or to the registrar's office should involve a set of step-by-step instructions that don't stop when you reach the front door of the building. They continue right up until you reach the office that you're interested in. One of the most exciting reasons for mapping interior spaces is to integrate mapping with what are called BIMs, or building information models. And the way that construction is usually done now is that a building design will start with an architect's model, which will be constructed within CAD software, and that software can then download that model into a building management software, the BIM, which will allow things like the climate control, the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, even the maintenance of individual rooms to be logged and kept records of during the process. And this is a real key to the green building movement, the ability to create buildings that use a lot less energy, which is going to be very much more important in the future. The nice thing about having three-dimensional models of the interior spaces is that we can use them for planning and design and construction. So, for example, if we needed to plan evacuation routes or if we wanted to calculate the optimal seating plan for a room or the optimal heating plan for a room during the vacation, let's say, we could use the model to do that rather than having to test the actual building. And probably the most exciting thing is that we can then create interior virtual environments that can be loaded into vision systems or immersive vision systems that would allow you to walk around within the buildings in a virtual sense, very much like the way you do inside Google Street View. And I often hold up the example of students in my online class, Geography 12, being able to come into my office in virtual space and have virtual office hours with me, talking face-to-face by some other mechanism. So I've actually been working on this for quite some time. It was over 12 years ago now that we built our first wearable or portable geographic information system with navigation capabilities, but that works strictly on the outdoors. Since then, we've been looking at how do we adapt it to working indoors. And we got started with what I call the virtual campus, a three-dimensional model of the campus, which originally we created by traditional digitization, but later we were able to get airborne LiDAR data, which I'll show you in just a second. We also were around the time that we were converting the blueprints of every building on campus, scanning them and converting them into computerized files. And that allowed us to get some of these digital files, and a class of mine actually created what we call virtual Phelps, or Phelps Hall, to be able to make that a three-dimensional model that you could actually walk through and experience. We worked extensively with the Google 3D Warehouse. Google has now discontinued this because it has a new proprietary way of creating 3D models. But we've had a lot of fun putting together 3D models. We've been also using Kinect as our first way of doing interior space mappings with some experiments in Ellison Hall. That led us to outdoor mapping using photogrammetry, and I'll explain that in just a second. But we originally started with kites, putting cameras on kites and holding them over things that need to be mapped. We later tried the same experiments with balloons, helium balloons, which allowed us to take cameras up and to map with them. That led us to the idea of a mapping robot. Buildings are mostly empty at night, so we figured night would be a good time to map building spaces. If we had a mapping robot which could just kind of creep into every room in a building, it only need go through once, map the whole thing, and we'd be done with it. As it turns out, there are companies right here in Los Angeles working on this exact issue. And then we later got into terrestrial LiDAR scanning, and I'll talk about that too. So the nice thing about LiDAR, light is light detection and ranging. It uses photons instead of radar to make maps. And the nice thing about light is that it can penetrate through vegetation and often reach the ground, even when there's quite thick vegetation. So some of the work we've been doing with LiDAR has been in Central America, where we have Mayan archaeological remains underneath a very dense tree canopy. We can map the remains without even needing to go there on the ground, although we have to go there on the ground to do some validation. So this is our initial model we created in 2006 of the campus. And as you can see, it's very easy to see the buildings. In this case, in Isla Vista, here's the lagoon and the campus buildings here. The detail is not very good on a particular building. This is Ellison Hall over here. But nevertheless, we did some important first learning with that. One of my classroom projects, our projects class in GI Science, we digitized every one of those building footprints I mentioned from the floor plans. So this is every layer of, or every story of Phelps Hall mapped independently. We found out that it's kind of a miracle Phelps Hall stands up, because apparently floors don't register very well with each other from the blueprints. But this allowed us to create three-dimensional models. And we did some initial experiments in building and texturing interior spaces that we could navigate to see how those worked out. Google SketchUp is a free tool that Google makes available. Been through several versions. It's been sold on now past Google. But it allows you to go in and do basic sort of CAD-style drawings on the footprint of a building on a satellite image or an air photo, and then to extrude the sides of the building and start adding digital photos that you might have of the building to be able to create that building and its textures. So here the roof has come from an air photo. The sides have come by photographing the sides of the building and pasting the photographs onto that. And for many years, we worked on creating campus buildings in Google SketchUp. If you go to Google Earth and turn on 3D mode, many of the buildings that you'll see in 3D in there are those that we created. But one thing we did learn that it's very important when you make these models to tie them to the terrain on which they're built. So this is the Davidson Library before it was modified and rebuilt. And you'll notice that you can see right underneath it here, because where the terrain dips, the model didn't dip, so we didn't get our registration quite right as far as putting the building model onto the ground. This is work of an undergraduate student of mine who's since moved on to other things, Kevin Wendler. He got the idea of using the Microsoft Kinect as a mapping tool. And we created this high-tech mapping device. The garbage can you see in the center there as a stable platform for the Kinect. Here it is. And we were able to move this around with the Kinect on the front and to map things like the interior spaces, the corridors of Ellison Hall. This is the interior of one of the workrooms, and this is Kevin himself being mapped by the Kinect device in 3D. This is Kitty Currier's work. Here she's in the South Pacific off of Indonesia. She got interested in mapping remote islands effectively. Most of these islands barely even appear on the charts today, so they are being mapped for the first time. She built this kite system. Here's the kite being launched here, and a platform that hung underneath it that could carry a cell phone-style camera that could be programmed to take lots of photographs from up on high, Okay, once you get all of those photos, you can bring them into a piece of software that we use quite extensively called Agisoft PhotoScan. And PhotoScan brings in enormous numbers of images. It processes them using a method called structure from motion. And it recreates the viewing geometry, that's the viewing positions from the kite of every one of the photographs, recreates three-dimensional geometry from ground points that come usually from GPS, and then uses that to map the topography. And we were able to produce quite a precise map that's in enormous detail. This one, which we've since published, and published as an interactive three-dimensional PDF, so that you can look at it in a sense of a browser. So from kites, we moved on to balloons. Here's our highly high-tech balloon made out of a sleeping bag, a Mylar sleeping bag, and a helium can. And from this, we slung a camera stabilization system. This is Tom Pingle, and we just simply let it up. Here it is looking down at the front of the chemistry building here on campus. And again, by taking lots of views from different viewpoints, we were able to piece them together to make three-dimensional views of the landscape. Some of the more important things that we learned from this was how to take video and use it to extract images rather than taking still photos, how to integrate GPS and video capture from a smartphone environment. We used an Android phone for this. We learned a lot about local winds and how they can take a balloon off without you expecting it to move very much. Here's our prototype MapBot, the very first one. You notice it's built on a vacuum cleaner base, a very, very common robotic vacuum cleaner that's often used. It's got a connect on top. It had one or two other sensors, and much of the rest of the weight was batteries. And we got this to work and actually moved into my office and was able to make one 3D scan before it went into permanent decline. Now, a great deal can be done with LiDAR information, and much of my work over the last few years has been looking at how do we take the information that comes from LiDAR and extract things from it. So here is the building model of the campus in which we've worked hard to extract the actual footprint of every one of the buildings, and that's not an easy task. So this is a part of the campus data, for example. You can see this is Phelps Hall, and you can see that two of the parts of it are hollow. Some of it has its roofs. Parts of the roof of Campbell Hall are missing. The roof of Ellison Hall is missing. And these are not buildings. These are trees. So trees come out the structures as well. And being able to extract the trees from the buildings became a pretty major problem in processing information from LiDAR. So our solution to this has been to use digital photogrammetry and structure from motion models in combination. And the question is, how many pictures do you need and how much detail? So we first have to create three-dimensional coordinate systems for entire buildings, and that's the first phase of the work. We've completed that work now. We need to examine the errors inherent with different 3D modeling systems and data capture methods, and we've been comparing different ways of compiling three-dimensional data at different resolutions with different types of imagery. We want to automate the extraction of non-structural features from point clouds. And by point clouds, you'll see a couple in a minute. But non-structural features means things like the furniture, the chairs and so on within this room, the equipment that's portable and not necessarily part of the permanent structure of the room. So in a desk, it might be, in an office, it might be desks and tables and chairs that are not necessarily part of the structure. And then the last issue we have is how do we generalize models, because it's very easy to capture enormous amounts of data from these models. Quite common to have 20 to 50 million points for a single room. Now, how do you know which of those points are the ones that we really want to keep? That has become a research top focus for us. So we've been mapping my office in immense details, a nice piece of interior space for us. Here we've got six different technologies. We've got two different point-and-shoot cameras, one very cheap consumer-grade camera, and then two relatively inexpensive webcams, which we mounted around the room and used them to make three-dimensional images and mosaic them together to make these 3D models. They look kind of patchy. Obviously, there are differences between the different methods. This one is from a Rigel laser scanner. This is a LiDAR scanner that we've been using extensively for modeling and mapping, not just in interior spaces, but for much of this last year, we've been mapping the nine points along the coastline here. to look at the effect of the erosion due to El Nino. So this is what the laser scanner looks like when you set it up. We need reflectors as registration points, and these are used to tie the images together. And obviously a fairly important tie is the tie between the indoors and the outdoors. Very, very important one. More about that in just a second. And it needs a whole bunch of equipment, and worst of all, it needs some very heavy batteries to work. So we were able to piece together these point clouds and build three-dimensional models. Here's an entire corridor. You can see through the different rooms on this side into the ones on the other side. This is the lobby and the stairwell, because we wanted to look at how we integrate one floor with another and what kind of accuracies we can get when we do that. Now, the coordinate systems issue is an important one, and for here we relied on some data we were able to access from UCLA. This is the UCLA library building here on their campus, for which LIDAR data had already been collected. So this is the work of my student, George Chan. He's been finding out how to automatically extract building edges from the LIDAR imagery, to then use those as kind of structural points to figure out where the floors are and the different floor layers. And there's then devised a way of automatically creating coordinate systems that allow any point on the surface to be referenced within a millimeter. So it's a millimeter-based integer system. In other words, everything's rounded to the nearest millimeter. It uses three tie points, which in this case were corners and the exterior points within buildings. We use false origins with offsets so that we will never have a point that's outside, even if the building were extended, that we would never have a point that fell outside the coordinate system. And the nice thing is that we worked out the geometry so that these coordinate systems can float with the object. So if the library at UCLA ever took up and moved, which it probably does during every major earthquake, we'd be able to use the same coordinate system after the fact, assuming it didn't fall down. But that goes for things like cruise ships and aircraft. So some of the issues which we're treating as actual research, we're dealing first with space abstraction. Here are three radically different ways of representing the same space. In this case, we're representing it as a point cloud. A point cloud is simply where a color sensor from a digital photo has been attached to every one of the range scans from the LIDAR. So we have a red, green, blue, X, Y, Z point in three-dimensional space. And if you make the points bigger and give them some color, like here they're like little dots, you begin to see the structure of the room. An alternative is to do that with triangles. If we connect nearby points with triangles, we begin to get a three-dimensional form. This is called a triangulated irregular network. Or alternatively, we can use little tiny cubes. These are called voxels. They're the three-dimensional equivalent of a pixel. And here is the same space at 10 centimeter pixels and at 25 centimeter pixels, and you can see it begins to look boxy as we get up to the more generalized level. In terms of generalization, we need to decide at some point how much information we want to keep. This is very important when we move into the visualization options. So here we see the same space abstracted by more and more triangles. You can see as we get more and more, we see more and more of the form, but we get a lot more extraneous detail. So how do we generate images? We need a lot of images from different angles. We need to overlap images to create a stereo model. We use the Agisoft PhotoScan software, which then extracts and assigns a point cloud, and does it pretty well. We can process these clouds with MeshLab, with Cloud Compare, and other software. Most of this is open source. And we decided that the solution to interior mapping was to use a drone or quadcopter to capture the information. We chose this one, the Phantom 4, because it was the latest one, and it includes collision avoidance. The last thing you want to do with a drone is fly it into a wall or into an object and break that object. So we have a little video here. I hope it's going to run. Let me try that. Nope, it's not going to run. Maybe that runs it. Nope. Can I get an assist, please, here? One slide back and click. Thank you. So we set the drone up. We chose a geography storage room just to give it a trial run. We're able to fly it around within the interior space. Here it's being remotely piloted by somebody who's actually flying it. You can actually move the camera separately from the flying. It's one with your left hand, one with your right hand. For outdoors, it's kind of easy because you simply program it into the software and it flies the drone for you over your flight path that you choose. But here we have to pilot around within the space. Okay, I'm going to move this ahead a little bit to the next. Can we stop and move on to the next slide? Thanks. So what that does is it captures a huge number of images. Here you can see me standing there with the camera I used to film that last video. And from those, we take it into Agisoft and we make the point cloud. So this is the data that we just saw being collected, put into Agisoft software, and turned into a point cloud. And I should point out that this is not a photograph. This is simply all those millions of little locations, each one assigned a little speck of color, and then integrated up to make a complete image. So we can... I'm going to need an assist on this video too. Can you probably turn that one on for me, please? When we bring the software in, this is the very model that we just collected. To start the video running, please. Okay. And you see that we can move around within this three-dimensional model, look at it from different perspectives, and be able to treat the data effectively. And this is a good example of where we've got detailed objects, things in a storeroom, and structural space. The structural space can be abstracted with only 8 points, the corners of the cube that formulate the room. But there are so many details in here that also need to be extracted that we have a quite complex formation problem to solve to be able to do this. Oops. So just to give you a sense of what I've done, I hope I've communicated the fact that mapping the great indoors is very much within it, in its infancy. We're in the very earliest days, just as the USGS was in the 1870s when it was setting out to map the entire country. We have barely yet begun to map the interior spaces of built America. The most promising methods that we've been able to provide include photogrammetry and the structure from motion processing, and this software is obviously going to get better and better over time. Right now, it's relatively inexpensive. We've been able to establish that LiDAR is truly the accuracy standard. It is the best way, so it's how we collect data against which we compare every other source. It would be better if it were cheaper, but it's a rather expensive way to collect data. But it has become the sort of gold standard. We've learned that we need new types of coordinate systems that transfer between interior and exterior space that work to different degrees of accuracy. We're quite happy with a meter outdoors. A millimeter is needed indoors. And we need those to be versatile enough to be able to move with the object like a ship. And we feel that doing this will enable many new applications in terms of GIS and location-based services. So thank you. And I believe we've budgeted some time to take some questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.